Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how it affects us all. I'm Andy Cersini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Anafuaken.
This week, Google nixes face recognition on glass, the U.S. Supreme Court okays DNA swabs, Zynga axes 250 employees, did Apple conspire with ebook publishers, and President Obama puts the hammer down on patent trolls. Now, as always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network, on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription link is in the right-hand sidebar. And also, we're on facebook.com/thedrilldown and twitter.com/thedrilldown. Before we get into our headlines, though, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. I don't really have anything that I want to talk about, but you have a little bone to pick, Dwayne, with viewers of Game of Thrones. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, HBO has done a wonderful job of translating A Song on Ice and Fire to this TV show, Game of Thrones, and it's great. And my bone, actually, I mean, obviously, people need to speak out. They get surprised. They get shocked. They're not people who read, apparently, so they don't know what the show's really what's going on, what the show's depicting. It's quite a literal translation of the actual books. My real big bone to pick is with Facebook and Twitter. Like, when they know something's trending, I feel like I should be able to block that trend. I shouldn't have to see of my like 1,200 friends on Facebook, like 600 separate posts of Game of Thrones horror. Or on Twitter, you know, when Game of Thrones is trending, especially on Twitter, where they quantify the trends very easily, I should be able to hardcore just be like, I don't need to see that. Block that for me. The Library of Congress can have it all. I don't need to see that particular thing. And that, like my Sunday, you know, my Facebook, like my phone was just blown. I would have to go into my Facebook settings and turn off the whole entire thing. None of the relevant Facebook posts were getting to me because it was all inundated with the Game of Thrones. Yes, is it viral? Wonderful. But for someone who spent the time to go ahead and read it and take a look at it and all that stuff, you know, it's and think frankly that the books are not quite super predictable, but you can figure out what's going to happen. The people have kind of taken the Cliff Notes expression version by going through the Game of Thrones thing. I get that they're excited and they're like, whatever. But I really just wish that Facebook allowed me to turn that off.
You just didn't want to see any of it.
With all the data they have on me, they know I watch. They know I read the books. It's in my favorites. My Goodreads is posted to it.
There should be some way to like block out the things. You know, I know Game of Thrones. I don't want to see it. Blah, blah, blah.
Exactly. My Goodreads is talk that I've seen. I've read the book Game of Thrones. I've read the book A Song of Ice and Fire. Like, I've done all that, you know?
Give Facebook 10 years, they will definitely have all that down automatically.
I've given Facebook 10 years. Almost. In less than a year, I'll have given Facebook 10 years.
Yes.
Come on, guys. I'm clearly not smarter than Mark Zuckerberg. He can figure this out.
They're still, you know, working on the granularity of what to tune in and tune out on your, you know, preferences, I think. Tosin, how about yourself? What have you been playing with this week?
So I recently decided to set up Google Shopping Express. And for those who don't know what that is, it's basically Google's beta one-day shipping experience in which you have several stores in the location, for example, Target and Walgreens, and someone will pick up whatever item you need and deliver it to your location. Currently, they're beta testing it within the Bay Area, so within, you know, San Francisco, within the, I guess, less left region of the Bay Area. Uh-huh. I'm not sure if it includes Oakland, but I tried it out today. Didn't really have anything I really needed, but I decided to order some small items, cookies, chips, things of that nature. And for the first 6 months that you sign up using, you know, Google Wallet, you get free shipping. So it actually worked very well and is really convenient. Nice little packaging. It seems like something that could definitely catch on.
So you actually got your delivery on the same day?
Yep. I ordered it, I think, around...
It's local stuff, though. It's not like you're ordering from someplace in New York or Kansas and getting stuff in the same day.
Right. So I actually ordered it at 10 a.m. And when you order, they give you different time segments in which you can choose to have items delivered. The initial opening day time segment was closed. So I think I picked one which was like 2 to 6 or something like that. And it arrived at 3 p.m. Now, I also – it also – what's really interesting is if your thing is not in – if it's not available in store, they can – you have several options. You can have it use the best available choice. You can have it not deliver anything. Uh-huh. Or you can also choose you know, what sort of qualities of the item that you want that you – need to have it picked up.
Oh, nice.
It can substitute.
I cannot wait for this to be rolled out. Now,
this sounds a lot like Seamless Web. When Tosin and I were in school, there was a thing called Delivery Express, which you'd order online or you'd call in, and they'd basically have somebody run around and get you the stuff you ordered. It was usually restaurants. So there's that. And New York does have a service, I forget the name right now, where you can order stuff locally and someone will deliver it to your job or to your house.
Sure. And Amazon's beginning to do this as well. Google's not the only one. Amazon's beginning to do it. And who else is beginning? Some other company, I believe, is also starting to roll out.
There's one company that's focused on doing this, and hopefully they'll get picked up by somebody because it's a great idea. There's a way to crowdsource the delivery and picking up of local things. People have different schedules, people have different whatever, and the idea that people will work together to solve these issues, like, oh, my dry cleaning's here, oh, this is over there, oh, that is whatever, that actually is heartwarming, and that's part of like the mobile technology that that makes us more connected than the typical discussion about how the internet breaks us up.
Yeah, I know there's a startup in the San Francisco area, and I'm blanking on the name right now, but what they're looking to do is have people run errands for other
people. Task Rabbit is the one in New York, and it's exactly the same thing.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's the name of the one that I'm familiar with.
It's a terrible name for a company because rabbits are involved. But other than that, it's fantastic.
Rabbits are fast. They get things done.
No, they're not actually. They're not fast.
Is that a misnomer?
No, hares are fast. Rabbits are not
hare.
Fast.
Ah, task hare. That should be the name.
Yeah, okay. But they're all disgusting.
Speaking of small furry pets, what is the Sad Cat Diary?
The Sad Cat Diary, and frankly, I guess we're skipping to the viral video situation.
Is it?
it's an amazing thing. Someone has written these diary entries from cats, and the cats are expressing their anthropomorphic concern, upsetness, adulation about the way we, their human overlords, behave about things. And it is incredibly poignant. It's incredibly funny. Google search, YouTube search, Facebook search for Sad Cat Diary, and you get stuff. I'll play the first one just so everyone can hear it.
Dear Diary, the authorities have removed the pair of black pants from the couch. There is no longer any place for me to sleep. I have vomited 3 times in protest, but there is no sign that anything will change. My only other hope for rest is on the computer keyboard, which is nearby, but sadly no one is currently using it. I will wait.
That's how a cat thinks.
That is so true. Amazing. Being a cat owner for many, many years, I can tell you that is so true.
I mean, scenario.
This is Z Frank who does this.
Say again? Yeah, Z Frank. That's who's done it. And it's gotten to a point where in my office now, when something happens, people will get on their iPhones with a voice memo and they will record a Sad Cat Diary and email it to the team.
Nice.
It's hilarious. It's great, and The reason why it's funny is because it plays on the whole correlation versus causation thing. They are behaving like this. Is it possible they actually believe and think this way?
Right.
Probably not. But they behave like it enough to make it hilarious for all of us.
We've been anthropomorphizing cats for, you know, for all our lives, for all our existence, coexistence with them.
And cats have a certain independence that makes them behave in a way that I think we tend to anthropomorphize in them first before we would do to dogs, who behave so with such unadulterated love and lack of cruelty that we tend to like think, oh, they're just dogs. But cats.
Okay, so let's get into our headlines for this week. A bit of a sad headline to start off with. Andrew Scott Rice, the co-founder of the company that makes the Oculus Rift virtual reality headset, was struck and killed while walking in a crosswalk last Thursday. The 33-year-old co-founder and lead engineer of Oculus was hit in Santa Ana by a speeding car being pursued by police, a Dodge Charger being driven by suspects in an unnamed alleged criminal activity, slammed into two vehicles during the pursuit before hitting Rice. The Oculus Rift head-mounted display captivated the game world since its crowdfunding campaign went up on Kickstarter and netted more than 1.1 million of donations in days. We've talked about it on the show before with the head tracking the head tracking that follows you. It follows the direction the viewer is looking and tracks the games that you play in that direction. It's just a tragic note that something like this should happen to someone whose career was obviously just emerging into brilliance, and who knows what we could have expected more.
Let's go even beyond his career. I mean, he's a young man.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, this is a young person.
Yep.
I mean, maybe he's not so young. I'm the same age. But the bottom line is that at 33 years old, your life is ahead of you.
Absolutely.
You've probably figured out what's up with love. You've probably figured out how your hair looks. You've probably figured out all these little things that you spend your entire life figuring out. So you can really focus on what you want to focus on. He's focused on the Oculus Rift virtual reality headset. And he was cut down.
Just a tragedy.
Exactly. I guess like Alexander the Great was cut down at 33.
Was he? I wasn't aware of that. He had conquered the world at that time. There were no more worlds to conquer.
Well, he conquered Europe. There's a lot of world left.
Yeah. moving on here, we talked last week about Google Glass, about the killer app for Google Glass being developed by this company who had developed a facial recognition software that would allow you to look at somebody's face, and then it would call up information about that person so that you don't feel like an ass when you can't come up with their name when you greet them or know anything about them, even though you've met them before. Well, it seems like Google's not going to let that happen. Google has outlined an official policy about glassware with facial recognition elements. They say, as Google has said for several years, we won't add facial recognition features to our products without having strong privacy protections in place. I can understand that. With that in mind, we won't be approving any facial recognition glassware at this time. Obviously, wearable computing that combines camera technology and always-on connection in a computing platform poses a bunch of privacy and security challenges, not just facial recognition. But it appears that Google has been feeling enough heat about this particular feature to ban the apps until they can get a policy in place.
And, you know, you call it heat, but I really feel it's understanding where the culture is. In Facebook, when they drop news feeds or, like, facial recognition tagging or whatever, they do it and they expect the backlash and they're like, we've moved culture forward. Google's done that from time to time with other things. But really, they're saying this technology is that important. It's so important to us that we talked about it before it was even ready.
And it feels like
so important to us that we've got our developers working on it in the open. It's that important. And it's so important. And there's been so much talk about how it's going to change our culture that in this respect, we can wait.
Yeah. I mean, that's what it feels like they're saying. It's so important and it's so nascent that we don't want to screw it up before it has had a chance to incubate. you know.
Yeah, I think people have to be more comfortable with the devices before they do that, and it's a smart move. I don't really rush toward the kind of conservative opinion lately, but I think this was a good way to go without having to sacrifice too much. Yeah, facial recognition not going to be totally available. Let's focus on voice right now. People are really comfortable with that.
You know, eventually they'll open up, but this takes some of the heat off of Glass because of, you know, they're already having inquiries by, you know, senators and other individuals concerned with their privacy. So this kind of massages it a little bit, saying, hey, we are concerned about such things and we do make our decisions based off of, you know, everyday concerns and society.
And society moves, and Google knows that. I mean, you look back 7 or 8 years ago, initiatives like gay marriage universally were like poo-pooed and downed by society. Now several states do that kind of thing. You look back 50 years ago, the Dred Scott case, or not even, like, you know, 100-something years ago, the Dred Scott case was there. And then there's Brown versus the Board of Education later. So you get these ideas of, like, the way the society moves. And Google knows it's going to move. Google will be around when the society
moves. It seems like we've gone through this so many times that we can almost predict an adoption cycle. You know, how fast to push something radical through. And how,
if there are no unforeseen circumstances, I agree with you. But there are always unforeseen circumstances.
Yes. Yes. Okay, so once again, cleaning up some news that we talked about last week when we talked about the Microsoft Xbox One. We talked about how the Xbox One really sort of planted itself as a set-top box more than focusing on any of their gaming elements in their reveal conference. And since then, Sony chief Kazuo Hirai said that the PlayStation 4 will differ from the Xbox One by saying, I fundamentally believe that the initial market we need to make sure we appeal to with any new platform is really the gaming audience. They will be the supporters of your platform and will help propel the installed base. Hirai acknowledged the PS4 will have non-game applications, but Sony will not emphasize those at the outset as it did with the launch of the PS3 in 2006. He said Sony would add other entertainment apps, but that's after we establish the platform as a video game platform. We want to make sure that we are there for gamers with our PS4 as well. They will go beyond this, but they'll definitely start with the gamer first.
It's a clear pivot. It's a clear, look what Microsoft's doing.
Yeah.
Let's not do that. I mean, the PS3 came out, and the world was different then, sure. The PS3 came out, and it was, on top of everything else, a Blu-ray player.
Yeah.
During a format war.
Yep.
So they had to emphasize Blu-ray. Now, I would say that, you know, with the three players of that age, of Generation 7 of the consoles, you saw Nintendo come out with a radically different interface that blew everyone away. You saw Xbox and PS3 come out with iterative interfaces and systems that were evolutionary rather than revolutionary. It turns out that when it came to the hardcore gamer, those guys won. And I think what Sony is basically saying is, we see what Microsoft wants to do, and yeah, it's cool. We don't have a Kinect interface.
Right.
We have Move, which is not as powerful as Kinect, which is not as popular as Kinect. So we are going to focus on the gaming. That's our strong suit. That's where we're going. And we need to look at what they dropped, and we're going to, like, you know, manage to the expectations of hardcore gamers. If they wanted to come out with a plan for how hardcore gamers would be able to play their PS3 games on their systems, that would probably give them even more good PR. But I think this is a good move.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like with both systems, with the PS4 and the Xbox One, the architecture is so similar compared to the previous iterations of both consoles that Sony has to find a way to differentiate themselves so that people understand what makes them different and not what makes them the same. And I think this is a good decision on their part. I do hope, though, because I'm already sort of leaning towards the PS4 in this console war. And I do hope that they do have some set-top box functionality.
Oh, they will. I am sure. I am sure that there's nothing the PS3 has that the PS4 won't have in terms of set-top box functionality. Yeah. That is not the challenge for Sony.
Right, and Sony is clearly also making it for social interaction, too, what we've seen in their previous press conference.
The question is how they do that without having a fee associated with it, because that was kind of the difference. I think they need to focus on security, especially when it comes to purchases. I mean, they were hacked a million times in 2011. You know, they need to focus on security and make that iterate on the PS3 experience. Which was, in the end, the PS3 looks like it lost out to the Xbox slightly, but it was a hugely, immensely successful device for them. And if they can iterate on that and do it in a way that doesn't cost a lot of money and gives consumers confidence because they have a fan base, then they're in really good shape. And, I would say that the Sony's done some wonderful things with both their TVs and their PlayStation. And one of the best things they do with both types of devices is the constant updates. Microsoft does this too with their Xbox. The constant updates that allow them to, you know, iterate and make it better. And that's not something that a manufacturer of televisions does. You know, it's a thing that happens rarely on other types of TVs. I'm confident that Sony will have a good solution for the Netflix and other things and watching other things.
I hope so.
And I think that the games, as long as they get good titles, will be great. I think there are the big challenges on the cable box front that Microsoft wants to jump into, and on the new interface front, which the Kinect has and which the Wii U has. Now, is the Wii U going to kick everybody's ass? Probably not, but it does have that interface that people are interested in, that Wii-based, different and exciting interface that people felt was a game changer.
I will say to the PS3's credit that they are ending their console run with a bang. The latest game come out from Naughty Dog Studios, The Last of Us, is getting a, we talked about Metacritic before we started recording, a 96 Metascore on Metacritic with a 56 positive reviews out of 56 from critics. So it's turning out to be an immediate hit before it's even released.
Yeah, I mean that's very exciting. I definitely don't think this series of systems is immediately dead.
Generation 7.
Right, like there's still lots of good titles coming out, and they still continue will be.
And there's months and months and months before the Christmas season shows up where these new devices come out.
Yeah. Also, to mention that I am going to E3 next week, and we're going to be talking about that on our next episode of the Drill Down, which we're going to be recording on a Thursday instead of Wednesday. Not that it matters to the listening audience, because they'll still get it on a Friday. Or worst case scenario on Saturday morning. So you'll hear from me, from my own personal experiences with the new PS4 and the Xbox One when we talk next time. All right, moving on here. Okay, so you brought this article to my attention, Duane. A narrowly divided Supreme Court ruled Monday that police can collect DNA from people arrested but not yet convicted of serious crimes, a tool that more than half the states already use to help crack unsolved crimes. The case described by Justice Samuel Alito as the most important criminal procedure case that the court has heard in decades represented a classic test between modern crime-finding technology and centuries-old privacy rights. In the end, justices had to balance the benefits and the intrusion of a simple cheek swab, and the considerable benefits won out. Justice Anthony Kennedy said in the writing about the majority's 5-4 decision, the DNA identification of arrestees is a reasonable search that can be considered part of a routine booking procedure. Taking and analyzing a cheek swab of the arrestee's DNA is, like fingerprinting and photographing, a legitimate police booking procedure that is reasonable under the Fourth Amendment. However, Justice Antonin Scalia, wrote in dissent, he said, "Make no mistake about it, because of today's decision, your DNA can be taken and entered into a national database if you're ever arrested, rightly or wrongly, and for whatever reason. This will solve some extra crimes, to be sure, but so would taking your DNA whenever you fly on an airplane." So, Dwayne, you brought this to my attention. How do you feel about this?
Technologically speaking, it goes to show what an age we live in. The idea that you're going to take these chemicals, this blueprint of man, put it in a computer, and zip it around and determine if they've ever been involved in anything else. Socially speaking, I'm incredibly uncomfortable with it. I'm past that curve of change is okay in my life, I think. But mostly I'm uncomfortable with it because we know that law enforcement can be corrupt. We know that government can be corrupt. Mm-hmm. So the idea that they can take your – and we also know that DNA – as a bit of evidence, has both saved a whole bunch of lives in terms of getting people off of death row and getting people out of jail, and has hurt a whole bunch of lives in terms of being wrong. And I don't think that we're at a place where our technology is sophisticated enough to, you know, use DNA, DNA that's taken on crime scenes or by a cop, or whoever in a holding cell or while you're getting booked, that's as foolproof as fingerprinting. So I don't know. I feel like it's a bit of a mess. But that said, I think the technology, the fact that the courts are having to rule on this technology, and the fact that they're ruling on this, the Constitution, which and the precedents set before that talk about how basically it's actually not an issue of privacy as much as it's an issue of invasiveness. And the fact that swabbing your cheek is just as invasive as putting ink on your fingers for a fingerprint or taking a picture of you, which makes a lot of sense. But the ramifications are bigger than that. And so the technology has eclipsed, I think, what the actual value is. Meaning the technology to take fingerprints, I showed up a long time ago, and that's really cool. And it wasn't as simple as saying, okay, here you go. But we've all seen movies where people have taken fingerprints and put them on a glass, like from someone else, and used tape to put them on a glass or whatever. And yeah, it's an extreme case or whatever. But you think about political foes, enemies, yada, 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 and you begin to see where this can be completely abused. And because of the respect we have for DNA evidence, it's clear that this can go in a very big brother dystopian way. So there's a chance of that. Obviously, you know, who knows when that's going to happen, if that's going to happen. But I feel like the technology is amazing that we're able to even have this discussion, what an age we live in. And it's interesting that the justices are basing that on ancient, not ancient, but hundred-year-old, documents. That's what they're basing it off of. Mm-hmm. Is it relevant?
Good question. Yeah. No, I think that's something that I think we should all sort of mold this over now that the ruling has been passed down. Think about how it's going to affect us in our daily lives.
It's pretty wild and scary to tell you that we've progressed to that situation when there's so many other things that we are questioning as a society in terms of being too much. For example, Google Glass, like people not wanting to have, you know, someone else with the ability to take the pictures. Well, now the government has the ability to do, I think far worse.
Yeah, what a wonderful analogy. Google's like, look, society isn't ready to have you recognized in your face, but the court's like, society is ready to have your genetic code in the database of the police for whatever reason. You know,
right?
that's a whole big difference. So, just interesting.
Let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I want to recommend this week is called The Innovator's Dilemma, Where New Technologies when new technologies cause great firms to fail. Let me just start over again and say that again. The Innovator's Dilemma, When New Technologies Cause Great Firms to Fail, by Clayton M. Christensen. Now, this is the book that you recommended, Tosin, last week. And it's I rarely recommend abridged versions of books on Audible, but in this case, it happens to be the only copy available on Audible is the abridged version. But it's a not very long book to read, and I think we're all going to be reading it soon, won't we? And I think you've already read this, Tosin, so you can tell us how good you think this is.
So I've only read part of the book. I've kind of been starting to go through it, and what I can tell you about it is that it's really about disruptive technologies and really what causes great companies to fail, which may not necessarily be what you think. So in the case of Clayton, the author of the book, he kind of guides you through a process which kind of shows that a lot of big companies fail because their inability to adapt, and also fail purely because they are listening to the needs of their customers and going for where the money currently exists and not taking chances. So far it's a pretty good read. It's very interesting. He provides a lot of examples from the past and from technology in the past, like the changing of disk drives from, you know, large floppies or even tape machines to three and a half and so forth. Mm-hmm. And he uses the past really to mold his theory and bring us to the conclusion.
All right. I'm looking forward to reading this. I love stories like this that give you sort of a meta overview of a certain aspect of technology, and this one, and I think this is actually relevant to what we're going to be talking about after the break here with the patent reform. So be looking forward to reading this, and then perhaps we can all talk about this at some later date. In any case, to download that free audiobook or any one of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles, all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. And that audiobook can be yours for free. Even if you don't like the Audible service, you can cancel it and you still get to keep that book. This applies to people who aren't already Audible subscribers. If you're not an Audible subscriber, audibletrial.com/thedrilldown, going to that site helps us on our show, so please do that. All right, we're going to take a little break and listen to some music, and when we return, President Obama wants to squash patent trolls, but will his plans make a difference? Take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Tosin Onufuwakin. Guys, it's a really, really bad time for Zynga. They're laying off 18% of their workforce, which represents 520 employees, in a bid to reduce costs and more drastically restructure its troubled business toward mobile, according to sources close to the situation. The move will affect every part of the San Francisco social gaming company and cut $80 million in staff costs. They currently have about 2,900 workers, but the action will also include the closing of its offices in New York, which, by the way, I realized from other reports that the New York offices are essentially the entire OMG Pop development studio that they purchased a while back when they bought Draw Something. Los Angeles and Dallas, as well as the slashing of other major infrastructure costs. The reason mobile, a business Zynga must conquer despite its currently smaller prospects for monetization compared to its web business, after a rocky IPO and trying to cope with the rapid changes in its core business, Zynga now must refocus the company's flagship franchises and network on the shift to mobile and narrowing of focus at the company. This comes as no surprise for me. I think we've been following Zynga's downfall for quite a while now.
Let's call it Zynga's trouble.
Yes.
They're cutting costs. They're not out of business yet. Now, will they be out of business? Possibly. But let's make sure we maintain a relative perspective here.
They're changing. They're cutting. They're losing 520 employees, and they're cutting $80 million.
Cutting $80 million is what you're thinking about. A company doesn't survive because it has lots of employees. Yeah. A company survives because it has money. When the management sticks around and the brand exists, the company survives.
But IBM will they have a second act after
IBM,
this?
IBM had like four acts. People thought it was down and out a whole bunch of times. But it pivots, and that's what companies do. I was in front of Zynga's offices last weekend, and that humongous warehouse of an office,
yeah,
Google New York style office, is one that is humongous and is incredibly expensive. It's like, you know, right in that Soma area, and it's expensive.
Sure.
And they're going to have to cut some costs and be a little less fancy. But they have the developers to possibly make out with this. Now, the OMG Pop purchase, it's clear that was a mistake. It's clear the diligence wasn't done, or the diligence was done and basically they were looking to see if they could pull off something that was amazing. I mean, that was their first truly native mobile app, I feel like.
Yeah.
Draw Something. And while they may close the New York office, I would imagine that some, if not many, of the developers over there were given invitations to move to the West Coast to work on their stuff. Because that talent, that mobile talent, for dynamic games like Draw Something.
Yeah, they just launched Draw Something 2.
Right. So, I mean, there's something there. They learned something from that. They've used something from that, etc. So I'm just saying I don't want to come across as dilettantes who are like, oh, this is happening and the news is talking about it. Therefore, you know, Zynga's doomed. I think Zynga's in trouble. But I think we need to just measure our response a little bit.
Sure. I think for me, though, the writing has been on the wall ever since their IPO. Ever since their IPO and the IPO being...
But we went over IPOs yesterday. We went over stocks yesterday. And stocks are based on a 20th century model of business that does not accurately reflect what technology is capable of or what it does or what it reaches. And you all agreed to that.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know that just because they had an IPO that didn't go very well, that they're whatever. I mean, Facebook had an IPO that went awfully. But they have the people and the knowledge and the smarts to be like, this went awfully, not just because of us, but mostly because the way the finance looks at us is whack. And that's why the NASDAQ had to pay money for screwing it up.
I don't know. For me, I just hear a lot of people jumping ship from Zynga in general. So a lot of those talented developers,
well, they're in trouble,
especially
no doubt,
in this area. I see a lot of that, as well as I'm trying to find this article, but I also read a recent article that that implied that Zynga, to try and keep their high level execs, is really trying to bolster their incentives, and that's something that some of their execs had already left, but trying to keep them, they're trying to give them incentives, and their CEO also dropped how much money he was going to make in the year to, I think, a dollar, but a lot of CEOs do that.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you want to keep your top talent if you can. We're in an age of acquihire. You know, when other big companies that are doing well right now see that your company might be faltering or having some issues, they're gonna jump to grab your top talent, whether they're coders or executives or whatever. So they're smart to do that. They understand where their value is. The value is not in having a New York office and having 520 employees that may or may not be doing anything productive. Just like Marissa Mayer is looking at Yahoo and she's figuring out who needs to go, because there have been a lot of people there for a very long time who all are not giving the kind of value that they're pulling out. So, I mean, am I a big fan of Zynga? I got to say I'm not. Would I buy Zynga stock? Probably not. But knowing how I feel about Zynga is, for me, very different from how other people react to their products. You know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that to me is the reason why I can't exactly write them off right now. Yeah, they've made some mistakes. Yeah. There have been a lot of people in digital who've been like, well, they were really good on the desktop but not so much on the mobile device. I got to say, whenever I played Zynga, it was on my iPhone or iPad. It was never on my actual computer. Mostly Words with Friends. For me, the big problem with Zynga, the thing that makes me not have a lot of love for them, is that they seem to take a lot of Parker Brothers and Mattel games and turn them into, you know,
yes,
knockoffs.
They do, don't they?
And I mean, you laugh at that, but that's a big indicator to me that they don't have what it takes to innovate.
Right. That's been a major criticism of Zynga in general since they've begun, not just Parker Brothers and not just first party board games, but with other people's flash games. They'll basically quickly churn out a ripoff of other developers' popular flash games. And
yeah, I mean, I don't want to demean them by calling it a ripoff. I'll call it a remix, because they do some things differently. But yeah, they think about it this way. There have been games in this world, board games, whatever, and Zynga has come out with games that are similar to those games on digital platforms like the desktop or mobile. And then they went out and they bought OMG Pops Draw Something. So the one game that wasn't a traditional or classic game was something that they purchased.
Sure.
And because of that, you begin to see, one, a little bit of a correction in the valuation of some of these companies like OMG Pop. I believe we'll see a correction in the value of Tumblr. And I'm still unclear as to how much Instagram actually cost. But in the end, I feel as if OMG, Zynga has never shown us as much innovation as they've shown us the chasing down of what's popular in the moment. Now, Farmville, I mean, that was a new concept. It was native to the whole Facebook world, Facebook app, voila. But after that, there was a series of titles that were popular for a bit, but were recognized. And part of the problem with mobile gaming, especially app-based gaming, is that I haven't ever played a game that's an app, whether it's a Facebook app or a mobile app, that I haven't eventually stopped playing because no matter the updates, it's like, oh, there's something new.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy come, easy go. Mm-hmm. It's a big cycle that moves very quickly, whether you're talking about the hardware or the software. And I think that's something that Zynga has been able to do a little better than some others. I mean, I would like to know how Rovio is doing, the makers of Angry Birds.
From
what I understand of Rovio, they've only really ever made Angry Birds, different versions of it. And they've been smart enough to put that thing on everything, right? That's on...
Yeah.
Tablets, it's on Windows, it's on everything, you know, and that's good.
Well, I mean, that's a big difference there, because I think with even as big as Zynga's biggest hits like Farmville or whatever their other biggest hit is, it is
represent incredibly different strategy.
It's a drop in the bucket compared to the worldwide dominance of Angry Birds.
Sure, and I think that Angry Birds, Rovio, did amazing things by taking Angry Birds and kind of taking this Netflix model of let's put it on everything.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. But I look at the innovation factor, and that kind of like conquest of devices doesn't last as long as you know, being able to come up with new games. And a game is a very difficult thing to make, not just to code, but to conceive and create the rules and universe around. So I'm you know, it's very easy to have that kind of one-hit wonder, unfortunately. So I'd like to, like, I do want to take a look at where Rovio is and then maybe get back to this next week, but I feel like Zynga is in a not-so-great spot. But that said, they're around, and there are a whole bunch of game companies that are not, you know. But they can't just buy Candy Crush. What's clear is that they can't just buy Candy Crush and be okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think with size reduction, Zynga will, I think, eventually just become a small company. I think they can definitely survive as a small company, but not anything, not a major player like they were hoping to become.
Right. I mean, if they had been more clever, they could have positioned themselves to a company like Nintendo back in their heyday, and when Nintendo was looking for a way to move past the Wii, and they could have gotten sold for a really large amount of money. But I think a lot of people looked at their IP and said, the intellectual property is not strong. They're about to undergo a whole bunch of lawsuits from Mattel and Parker Brothers for copying their game ideas and yada, yada, yada. So it's unclear. But I do feel like Zynga had the ability to position itself on the market and avoid what they're in right now. And, you know, maybe, you know, they obviously, like, whoever bought them would be in some trouble if the company had no legs. But they can probably benefit from the management of a larger company that understands what's necessary to get consumers spending money on the platform, on like the games they make.
The question is, would any company even really want to touch Zynga at this point?
That's the problem, yeah.
Bad PR and whatnot.
Yeah, that's true.
You think Zynga hurt themselves with their dependence on Facebook as a platform?
You know, I don't. I feel like they worked really well with Facebook, and they were smart enough. I mean, we were talking about this a year or so ago.
Yeah.
To say they're going to play their games on Zynga.com. Facebook is a way to spread the word. Whether you're playing a game, taking a picture, or whatever, or you have a video that's about to get viral, Facebook is how word is spread. And an app, a game that is integrated with Facebook is not very different from installing a video on Facebook instead of YouTube. It's a way to get your stuff out there. They have a million users. You don't need to make an app for that and spend the 45 cents per user to get a billion users. If you can just put it on Facebook and get a whole bunch of people excited on you, then you build your brand underneath a game like Farmville. And then you say, hey, you want to play this game? Come over to our website. It's not too bad. You can even still log in with Facebook. I mean, that's a solid strategy. It's just that the innovation wasn't there to keep users coming back. And it wasn't there to keep new users of Facebook, because people are aging into Facebook all the time. They're hitting that 13 years old. They're getting their Facebook account. It wasn't enough to keep them there, especially as mobile grew so quickly and so powerfully.
Right.
You know, it was and then they weren't prepared for that, it seems. So that's I think, the heart of Zynga's problem.
All right, let's move on here. Apple Inc. has conspired with publishers to raise the price of ebooks in a scheme costing consumers hundreds of millions of dollars, a U.S. government lawyer said on Monday. A 3-week trial got underway before a federal judge in New York in a case pitting the Justice Department against the popular iPad and iPhone maker that could shine a light on the secretive Silicon Valley's giant's business practices. Apple told publishers that Apple and only Apple could get prices up in their industry, Lawrence Buterman, a lawyer at the Justice Department, said during opening arguments. The trial came more than a year after the department sued Apple and five of the largest U.S. publishing houses, accusing them of working together illegally to increase ebook prices and undo Amazon.com's market control.
Dominance.
Yes.
So the big thing here is that they were working with these other companies, and all those companies have settled. All those companies have been like, we don't want to go to trial. We'd rather spend money and make you feel good right now, Justice Department, than have everything exposed and have to pay for possibly getting caught in some wrongdoing. And Apple, with its deep pockets, has been like, nope, we're going to the bitter end. And recently, email messages have arisen between Steve Jobs and Rupert Murdoch's son and other people, who which have shown that Steve Jobs was highly aggressive, and that these emails are showing that he's possibly engaging in criminal activity by promising to fix the prices. By fix the prices, we mean set the prices, not by market standards, but by having the entire market collude with him and determining what a price for a book was that would make them happy. That's bad news. That interrupts his legacy in a very damaging way. And I feel like in many respects, this continued Apple suit, despite the fact that everybody else has quit and settled, might have much to do with keeping his legacy intact.
I don't know. I think by now everyone knows that Steve Jobs had some temper and had another side to him.
Well, there's temper and then there's price fixing. Then there's things like WWDC 1997, where he's saying, for Apple to win, no one has to lose. For Apple to win, we have to make great products. That's the Steve Jobs that is his legacy. And for these emails to come out showing that he's interested in making sure the consumer pays more simply because, without the context of saying perhaps, well, you know, people don't understand the value of books and we're looking at the market and how much it takes to make a book and we think that we can actually like work with you guys to get the price to a place where it's profitable. We're not seeing that. We're seeing Steve Jobs be like, this is where the book should be. We'll work together to get it done. That's uncomfortable.
He was very direct and very – he knew what he wanted, and he wasn't afraid to push things over the line to get it.
What you're talking about is the difference between like people understanding what's right and what's wrong and people understanding what consequences are for the things they want to get away with. And that's where the legacy begins to be diminished and tarnished.
Yeah.
Because it's clear here that he wasn't thinking about right and wrong from the classic perspective.
Right.
What Apple had the market power to do.
I'm not saying I agree with it, but he was definitely –
It's dirty, dude. John Gruber said it's dirty.
Well, if John Gruber said it's dirty, wow. yeah, then it must have been dirty. Yeah, no, for sure. It's clear that Apple seems to have been applying the same process towards ebooks that they did with music, and except the difference is that since they've dominated music, all the other industries have gotten wise to their leverage points in their industry. You know, that's why movies haven't been as easy to conquer as music and ebooks, I think, as well. I think that's why this is an issue.
You know, sure, Steve Jobs' legacy will go down a bit, but I think everyone who's in the know-how is already expecting it. Anyone who's already an Apple fan probably doesn't really care that much. They just care about the products that they have. So these are people who may not be, you know, the technophiles. And then anyone who's already in the Android fanboy class will just have another thing to light their fire. So ultimately, I don't think it makes much of a huge.
So how do you feel? Where do you fit in that spectrum that you just laid out?
I feel like, okay, I expected it. Doesn't surprise me. This is going to be another one of those trials that goes on for ages, and we'll find out about this in, you know, another 6 months to a year, what ultimately happens, but not surprised at all.
Gotcha. And that you guys, I don't know. I feel like I don't know where I fall in the spectrum that you laid out. Am I an Android lover? I like it. I don't love it. Am I an Apple lover? I don't use a Mac as my main machine. I still prefer Windows for my main laptop. Although I do have a Mac and I use it a lot. I don't know how I feel about all that. Like Steve Jobs, I thought he – as I look at CEOs and the companies that I work at, I'm constantly comparing them to him.
Yeah, and to note, on my scale, I was really using fanboys as terms of, you know, as distinct ends of the spectrum.
Sure, yeah, I got it. I'm just wondering where – I mean, I look at that and I wonder where I fall in on this podcast, where Andy falls in, where you fall in. And I don't exactly know where I fall in. I probably lean a bit more Apple than I do hang out in the middle. But I would say that this is unimpeachably whack.
Yeah, I mean, I like Apple products. I like using them. I've always been platform agnostic for, you know, for the longest time. Over the last few years, though, I find that my everyday usage has swayed more on the Apple side, and I don't think it's a matter of making a personal choice one towards the other. It just happened to be how it all sort of played out, and maybe I'm a victim of being caught in the Apple ecosystem with the iTunes and the App Store and all that. But I still feel that regardless of my preference, I think that a company should adhere to certain practices, there should be a sense of fair play in their business practices.
Yeah, I agree. Like, you know, what they did is wrong, and really companies should hold themselves to a high esteem. Similarly, you know, I know a lot of people feel the same way about the government. The government should be able to hold themselves to a higher position, similar companies and then individuals too. So I definitely, you know, I think they should be scorned for it and punished accordingly. But to say that I didn't expect something like that from Steve Jobs would, I think, to be an error on my part, especially from some of the stuff we've read, you know, previously.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on here. So, boy, this is another big one. This week, the White House announced major steps to improve incentives for future innovation in high-tech patents. The White House issued 5 executive actions and 7 legislative recommendations designed to protect innovators from frivolous litigation and ensure the highest quality patents in our system. The measures would, among other things, increase the burden on patentees to fully disclose updated ownership information, loosen requirements for contentious patents to be reviewed, and insist on, quote, demand letter transparency, meaning anyone filing claim letters against alleged infringers would have to make those letters publicly available and searchable. The administration's 5 executive orders, which start taking effect this week, require greater transparency in how claimants use shell companies to enable abusive litigations. That's the we've seen that before with the what's the name of that company, the famous company, something Ventures.
The patent troll company.
Yeah.
Basically, so it doesn't really matter what their name is, as much as it matters that they were funded to buy patents, and once those patents were bought or whatever, they basically, their entire staff is lawyers who go out looking for where those patents are violated or could be violated and attack the companies or individuals that may have violated those patents to the point where they either go to court or they just decide to pay a settlement fee because they're like, I can't afford to go to court. So basically the whole business model is patrolling patents and getting money for them.
Intellectual Ventures. It's Nathan Myhrvold's company.
Yeah, and I mean, these people are at the heart of what I think Silicon Valley as a whole has deemed as, you know, for Silicon Valley, this is considered incredibly evil. I mostly think that this is an example of the patent system not as it is, not being able to maintain its spirit in the current age. And that's a problem.
Yeah, and it's good to see that the you know, White House is taking steps or the government is taking steps to fix and alleviate these issues. The ultimate, you know, we see all these patent conflicts over the years and all these trolls, and it, often it's really just up to the judge to make the correct decision. And let's get a little bit more transparency in the actual legislature, and let's get some firmly grounded policies in play. So step in the right direction. We'll see what happens as it evolves.
Right. I mean, there was some things that brought this to a head, guys. It just didn't kind of come out of nowhere. In the
sure,
the, you know, there were two things that really changed the game, I think, in recent times. One was the Samsung Apple worldwide patent war,
sure,
which is winding down the way we're winding down in Afghanistan, but it still goes on. Just yesterday, the ITC, the United States ITC, International Trade Commission,
ruled in favor of it,
ruled in favor of Samsung against Apple about patents, which is something that Apple has been not only prosecuting and chasing Samsung around the world for, but has also been marketing. And here, you know, they come out and some of their devices are going to be possibly banned from sale. Meanwhile, podcasting, the enterprise that we're in, and that has changed the game for appointment listening on the web, is basically it's turned into taking radio and making it digital. That is under attack from another patent, an entire industry attack from a single patent.
Right.
So
there's no way that's the only – I mean
– you're talking about sentiment. Let's talk about data. These people are making decisions based on law. And law is the kind of thing where a judge makes a decision not because something's right but because something is written. And if it's a lower court, they do it based on the law it's written, and it has to go up to an appellate, whatever, and yada, yada, yada. And sometimes we have to deal with the consequences in the meantime. You know, this happens all the time.
Yeah.
So it's I'm not going to go as far as call it scary.
I don't see much hope
concerning
for that one being awarded to the claimant.
Right. So I mean, Tosin said it, like, there has to be some common sense policy built around what intellectual property is and what can actually be patented.
It's a little
concerning that we're not there yet. I mean, we can talk about this more when Chris is on the show, but it's disturbing.
So the question is now, do you think that the president's proposed measures are going to have an effect? I read an article here in Quartz that gives a sort of a bullet point by point reason why these provisions aren't going to have an effect, how they're basically toothless.
Well, he comes out against them, but the fact is, patents are in the Constitution, and Obama's here for 8 years. The Constitution is the big dog. So, I mean, Tosin, you live in Silicon Valley. How do people feel about this?
Hard to say, because although I live in Silicon Valley, I also live...
And you work at a top startup.
I think in general, when it comes to patents and intellectual property, companies are, you know, companies and individual are very protective of it. And I think more often than not, a lot of the, you know, at least a lot of the little companies that you talk with, the various startups, really just want the stuff focused and produced in a fashion that you know, A, protects their intellectual property, but also, you know, allows there to be, you know, strict boundaries so that they can know what other properties that they may be able to utilize. Because right now, I just find that it's quite unclear when it comes to, you know, we've seen some of the things that Apple has been able to successfully covet for extended periods of time, and whether or not that's acceptable within the guidelines of what we expect for a copyright, especially when we think of copyright in the terms of this internet day and age. So, you know, specifically for applications and other categories, I think that's definitely something that that as long as there's better guidelines around it, it'll make life a lot easier. Because really, you know, when it comes to copyright, often it's the big dogs that that are, you know, the most successful and have the most money to throw around in those areas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'd love to see. Believe me, we've patent litigation has been a common thread in many of our past episodes, and we're very aware that there is definitely a problem and it has to be solved. I'm glad that the that Obama is stepping in and voicing an opinion and putting some ground rules in place. It's just I would just love to see. I'm very hopeful that these will be enforced in a way. You know, one of the negative criticisms about this that this Quartz article brings up is that that it's got zero effect on existing patent troll portfolios. So it only will affect ones going from here forward, which, you know, there's all of the major companies have scores of portfolios that this won't affect at all, that they're still that are part of their war chests. So we could still be dealing with the grandfathered effects of before this set of rulings for a long time to come, and ultimately patent litigation stifles innovation, which has been my main bone of contention with the way patent law runs right now. So we'll see. I'm very hopeful. I completely kind of forgot about this story, but I'm looking at my Yahoo right now. They're planning on digging up the landfill where they reportedly buried all of those old terrible E.T. video games.
I heard about that.
Did you hear about this, Dwayne? You know what's going on here?
No,
okay,
I don't.
So,
but I'm depressed that this is like a story.
Okay, so back when E.T. the movie was released.
Oh, I know about the tragedy that was the E.T. video game.
Yes.
I know about
that. I mean,
that.
They really did rush out. Like, it was a cheap rush job of making this video game. It was actually started off as another video game entirely, and they essentially just kind of pasted E.T., you know, pixel sprites onto that existing game. And it was such a tragic, like, a disaster. Like, nobody bought this game, and it was so bad and poorly made that the retailers were stuck with hundreds and hundreds thousands of copies of what they thought was going to be a huge seller in the wake of E.T. So instead of selling it as at a discount, Atari took all the unsold copies and buried them in a landfill in New Mexico, Alamogordo, New Mexico, because they didn't want anyone to, you know, have these for free. You know, it was basically a write-off. There's a Canadian movie studio who's doing a documentary on this story, and they've been allowed by the Alamogordo city commissioners to dig up the landfill. So they're going to be doing it pretty soon. I don't know.
Here's the question: can you find an emulator online? I've been trying to find it for like a couple weeks now, and
oh yeah. Oh, yeah.
If I can find an emulator for it, I'd be so pleased.
In fact, I think not only that, but I think that you can even play the ROM for the E.T. game exists. It's out there somewhere, and you can play it now if you want to. I wouldn't recommend it. It's a terrible game.
No, I have the Atari's Greatest Hits thing on my iPad, yeah, which is the most confusing metagame I've ever had. But it'd be great. I just want to play that AT game.
I will send you the links for the game, for the ROM, and an emulator for the Mac. Or I don't know, what are you using?
That's fine. It doesn't matter. What I'm saying. Yeah. I'm all about each platform.
I will send you that stuff. I think that is the last story before we get into the viral video stuff. And I actually have two stories here. One of them is very short. And I'm not even going to attach a video because ultimately I would be Rickrolling everybody. But A web developer managed to bypass the 6-second upload limit on Vine, inserting the entirety of Rick Astley's immortal Never Gonna Give You Up into a post that was ultimately taken down by Twitter. He has experience developing for Android, and when Vine came out for Android, he decompiled the app, then recreated portions of the Vine API that enable users to create posts, add titles, insert thumbnail images, and from there he downloaded the Never Gonna Give You Up music video, and using methods he declined to describe until the Vine app is patched, he posted the file to the app servers. And suddenly, the 6-second video app was hosting an infinitely looping 3.5-minute Rick Astley classic, essentially Rick rolling any Vine users who were looking at his post.
It's good to see some memes never die out.
You know, that's ultimately what I got
There's
out of this.
Always a new platform.
Yes.
And when you have a new platform. Rickrolling is not a meme. It's more than a meme. I mean, yeah, it's a meme in terms of it took on its own life, but it is a rite of passage for a new platform.
It's like Hello World.
Yeah. It's a rite of passage. Any new platform needs to have Rick Astley there. Rick Astley's video will long outlive him. I still don't really quite understand why it's not just thought of as the most awesome song from the 80s because I love it. But,
I think it's a great song, too.
Yeah, because it's never going to give you up. It's never going to let you down, you know? How many times can you say that to someone? And really, what the meme has shown us is that regardless of the platform, you know, half a decade later, it's never going to give up.
It's still relevant.
It's only going to take Vine down.
And the other thing, the last viral video thing I want to talk about, besides the Cat Diary, which we already discussed, is last week we talked about the release of season 4 of Arrested Development on Netflix. And since then, one of the show's fans has taken it upon himself to re-edit the entire 4th season in what he calls chronological order. And he's released the downloaded episodes of his version of the show on Reddit via Mega. He took apart all the episodes and then put them back together again for a different interpretation of season 4. He says he did it as much as he could to make these feel like real episodes, to make sure to separate the episodes by storyline rather than looking for specific times. He said, I try to keep as much of the original editing as possible unless chronology required a split. So anyone who's seen any of the episodes of season 4 know that there are intertwined stories running through the season, and occasionally we'll get to see the same story being told from a different perspective, or sometimes occurring in the background of somebody else's story. And so this is interesting that this user, Reddit user, has managed to re-edit this entire season and put it all in chronological order. I'm intensely curious about watching this from both a fan of Arrested Development perspective and also the perspective of being a film editor myself, to see how he's done this.
It's always amazing when someone's able to take something that's been edited and produced and put something together that makes sense without having the actors on hand to make any like new changes. I mean, it's always amazing. I saw this with the 7th Star Trek movie. The fans hated the fact that Kirk died, so there was a Kirkless version, and Kirk just wasn't in it, and it was a perfectly fine movie. These things happen, and I think it's great that – so Arrested Development, you know, came to Netflix, and that's all sorts of awesome. This is one of those things where the geek culture is part of the mainstream culture.
Yep.
And I don't think geeks will have a difficult non-geeks will have a difficult time finding this, watching it, and kind of beginning to pass that kind of stuff on.
Yeah. According to the article, the original editor of the of season 4, Kabir Ashtar, gives his stamp of approval on what he's done, on what this Redditor has done. So looking forward to seeing it. Yeah,
because he wants Netflix got this series because of user participation, because of an online community and DVD sales and people watching it that really, really loved it. So it's only natural that Netflix looks at this and says, all right. I mean, Netflix has also been very, very good at saying, yeah, we may not have done that exactly right. Flickster, remember? So it doesn't strike me as surprising that Netflix is like, or a representative of Netflix is like, that's actually pretty good. Maybe this guy could get a job with us.
I certainly kind of hope for Netflix's sake that they don't do like a cease and desist on this, that they kind of let it exist.
I think that if anything, you know, especially with this executive or this producer being here and saying, hey, I think this is kind of cool, they'll maybe cease and desist it so they can buy it and put it on Netflix.
Well, that would be interesting.
I mean, that would be, they'd have to figure out a way to show people, hey, look at this version or that version, whatever. But Netflix is dynamic. And this is just another example of how, you know, maybe the way the market looks at them is not necessarily a true reflection of their actual value. People are taking their product and they're participating with it, which is exactly what people want to do with media today. They don't just want to sit down and watch it, Game of Thrones viewers aside. Even those guys are just like, that shows us completely that people are crazy about it. They want to talk about it. They want to do whatever. They want to have their input, you know?
Yeah.
And the best expression of input is either, you know, if you have the capability of Saturday Night Live and you could lampoon it, that's a wonderful expression of input. But barring that, how about I take it and I make it what I think a lot of the people who are my friends who love it would appreciate? And I think that's what that producer saw when, you know, he was flattered when that guy was able to take all the work he did and put that together in that situation.
Yep.
Voila.
All right, let's go around the table here. I'll start with you, Duane. Where can we find your work online when you're not here on The Drill Down?
Check me out at twitter.com/DwayneD. That's DwayneD. Also check me out at flavors.me/DwayneD. And you can always find me here on The Drill Down.
And Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321, T-O-A-S-T 4321, as well as you can find my other ramblings at ircwebcast.blogspot.com.
As for myself, you can find my stuff at mrbabyman.com. Also, I'm on Facebook and Twitter, Mr. Babyman. Just do a Google search. You'll find me. As for The Drill Down, if you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. We'd love to hear from you, so one way or the other, let us know what you think of the show. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. You can let The Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location, and we'll be talking about E3 and WWDC then. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.